להיות שם, תבקשי משאלה ואני אבקש חזרה. ואם אתה שומע את קולי בחלום, אני לא אוותר עליך. והימים עוברים והלילות קשים, הלב מדמם והנפש שלי כבר.
Bienvenidos al episodio 4 de la cuarta temporada de Goy Friendly. Este episodio va a ser completamente en inglés, en un inglés con acento brit, porque nos visita John Aziz, hijo de padre palestino y madre británica. Es un episodio realmente intenso, emotivo, lleno de verdades y de esperanza, ¿por qué no? Así que quizás mi amigo Apu pueda completar un poco antes de arrancar el episodio.
Yo solo para agregar que John nos cuenta que él no es el único, que conoce mucha gente que también quiere la paz del lado palestino, que quiere reconocer Israel y convivir. Y dice que el 7 de octubre es lo que lo conminó a él a hacerlo público, a hacer públicamente, pararse en las redes y decir yo quiero la paz con Israel. Para pensar que de las peores tragedias también puede salir una lucecita de esperanza.
No demoramos más entonces el comienzo de este episodio. Esperamos que lo disfruten tanto como nosotros y agradecemos especialmente si pueden difundirlo.
Hello everybody, this is Pasante desde el Mossad. This is the episode number 4 of the 4th season of Goy Friendly. The last episode was really tough. We had to have a conversation with someone that helped us to understand what happened with UNRWA, how we feel about it, what does it represent to the possibility of having two states as a solution that most of us did want in the past, and we might think that it can still be achievable. But it was really a hard episode. We also discussed a portion of reality that was hidden for many of us, which is that most Palestinians maybe don't like two states. Many actually raise their voice to ask for the destruction of Israel, so that there's no two-state solution anymore there. And we left open the possibility to just find people that actually are Palestinian or are engaged with the Palestinian cause. I would like a two-state solution to let them know that they are not alone, that we want the same thing. And I really hope that I didn't freak out our guest today, which is going to be presented by Apu. Just shukran for being here, but I'm going to let Apu introduce him.
Hello. Our guest today is John Aziz. He was born in Britain, in the UK, from a Muslim Palestinian father, an English mother. He spent his life in two worlds, visiting and his family and speaking in starting some phrases in English and finishing them up in Arab and vice versa. At some point, and that's maybe where I want to start the conversation with him, he stepped out, at least for my view, stepped out. He has been participating in pacifist calls in places like London, which is one of the epicenters of Islamism today, in my view, at least. So he's putting himself out there and getting, at least from me, a lot of praise, but also probably some hateful comments from other people. So welcome, John. Maybe I would like to start asking, what do you think is different? What is different in your message from the crowd in general? And also, if you could tell us a little bit about your background.
Hi, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm John Aziz. I'm a Palestinian British guy. I've lived in the UK and the US my entire life. I have visited Palestine on 3 occasions. I've experienced, you know, going through military checkpoints in the West Bank, you know, visiting my family, which is wonderful. The West Bank's a beautiful, wonderful place to live. Perhaps why it's so attractive to so many Israeli settlers. But in terms of my message and maybe what's different between me and, you know, other parts of the Palestinian political spectrum, I kind of see myself first and foremost as an advocate for peace, an advocate for a two-state solution, advocate for human rights for, you know, people on both sides. And I suppose one of the things that really does differ is that I'm, you know, very willing and very excited to talk with Israelis, to talk with, you know, people in the Jewish diaspora about this, rather than just focusing on, you know, going to a pro-Palestine protest and, you know, it's going to be, you know, shouting from the river to the sea, which is an attitude that sends maybe Israelis in a direction that they don't like. They feel like maybe that's a call for ethnic cleansing, really, and you know, at least a call, potentially a call for persecution of them. My attitude is much more that we need to reach a bilateral agreement, and that's only going to happen through people on both sides adopting kind of a "I scratch your back, you scratch my back" kind of approach, where both sides are really trying to make things easy for each other. And I think one of the most important factors here is that we mutually recognize that neither side's going anywhere, right? Palestinians and Israelis are both fairly indigenous to the land, both with a long history in the land, both with a national consciousness related to the land, and that means that neither side's going to be kicked out. It's completely absurd to have this suggestion where, you know, one side removes the other from the land, and that's something that I would reject, both on moral grounds, because obviously ethnic cleansing is wrong, but also on practical grounds because of the strong ties. You know, I think the Jewish nation has kept like a, you know, 1800 year bond to the land before the modern movement of Zionism. So am I particularly different from any other Palestinians? No, there's lots of Palestinians who have similar perspectives to me to a certain extent. I'm definitely part of the Palestinian spectrum of political discussion. And I think that my method would be the most fruitful approach that would be most likely to guarantee, you know, peaceful coexistence between the two different sides.
John, I read a piece you wrote. I think it was in The Atlantic. After share with me.
Yeah, I've had a piece in The Atlantic last year.
And I was listening to you right now, and I thought, okay, maybe for an Israeli or a Jewish guy, like really like a proud Zionist, it sounds after October 7th, too little, too late. But I understand that is like you say, nobody's going to go anywhere, and we have to deal with that and do something with that. But that's from the other side. What I would like to know is what happens with you when you say this out loud on the Palestinian side. Do you get death threats? Do people like isolate you? Do people come up, reach out to you and say, you know, bro, I think like you, but I am afraid to speak out loud because people are going to just start insulting me, telling me that I'm a traitor, I am a Assad agent, or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, look, the reception has not been entirely positive. I very much expected that because, of course, I think a large part of the Palestinian identity, certainly for many people, is predicated upon the idea that there is one Palestinian land, that it's the river to the sea, and all of that is Palestine, and a two-state solution is treachery. I grew up watching other Palestinians call people like Abu Mazen a traitor, right? So
from a Hamas side, it's something like, yeah, makes a lot of sense.
Certainly, and that's where the discourse is among, you know, Hamasniks. They think that the PA in general are traitors. My perspective is not that different from a lot of people in the PLO, with the exception that I try and establish more common ground, I suppose. I try to establish more common ground between Palestinians and Israelis. So yeah, of course, I've had some death threats. I've had some, you know, horrible, horrific messages. But that is to be expected, because we have to remember that there is a lot of trauma going on at the moment on the Israeli side. Of course, there was the October the 7th with all the murders and rapes. And on the Palestinian side, there are a lot of people dying in Gaza right now. So people on both sides are feeling radicalized. So I was expecting to get a lot of pushback from my own side. And I think a lot of people on my own side also, you know, when I start advocating for things like nonviolent resistance and dialogue and negotiations, people will throw their hands up and they'll say, oh, so you want us to just sit there and eat hummus with the Israelis? And then what? If it doesn't lead to a tangible improvement in conditions for Palestinian people on the ground, then people will be frustrated with that. There can sometimes be a sense that, you know, peace dialogue's good, but it's not solving my problems. It's not solving the problem of the guy in the West Bank who has to go through a checkpoint every day on his way to work. He has to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and then he has to go through a checkpoint on the way home. So I understand that Palestinians are frustrated with the status quo, but I sincerely believe that the only way that we can fix this is through mutual dialogue and compassion for people on both sides.
So was it October 7 that made you want to speak up? And if that's the case, when did you start feeling or thinking differently, even if you did not speak up?
So I've had my views for probably about nearly 15 years, I would say. I've all, entirety of my adult life, right? I've had roughly the same views that I have now, with some augmentation from reading more and from, you know, engaging in dialogue with both Palestinians and Israelis. So my views did not come from October the 7th. What came from October the 7th and the period afterwards is, I think, there was more appetite among maybe the Israeli peace camp, which would have been very disillusioned even before October the 7th. But obviously what happened on October the 7th looks like a climax of all of the worst things that could have possibly happened. So a lot of people, maybe Israeli diaspora Jewish, were looking for Palestinian voices for peace. And I think beyond that, in the wider world, of course, people see the ongoing war in Gaza and they want to hear from voices who don't want to live like that anymore. So I think there is a wider appetite for these kinds of, you know, voices of people who want to have an approach of dialogue and negotiations and in the long run, peace.
When you say reading, what kind of reads are you referring to?
One of the most important books that I read was Jerusalem by Simon Sebag Montefiore. So that gave me a much broader sweep of the historical context of, you know, what's happened throughout the ages. Of course, I have read the, you know, some of the more texts that are more typified as being pro the Palestinian narrative, like Ilan Pappe's The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. On the other hand, I read Einat Wolf's The War of Return, which is another, that's a different, more kind of a Zionist perspective on the Nakba and the ongoing, you know, struggle between the concept in Palestinian society of we have a right to all of this land belongs to us, and versus Israeli perspectives sometimes, which also say we have a right to all of this land. I read this topic a lot. I spend a lot of time reading Wikipedia articles. that's another source. And of course, I will then go and sometimes I purchase books based upon things I read on Wikipedia articles. I read a lot of Twitter. I read a lot of Foreign Policy magazine. I read a lot of The Atlantic magazine. I read a lot of Bloomberg. So I consume a steady and rich diet of information on this topic. Even before October the 7th, this was one of my main interests.
You mentioned that you went three times to the Palestinian territories.
Yes, right.
Did you go through Jordan or did you go?
I've been in both routes. I've been in through Ben Gurion Airport. I've been in through the Allenby crossing, I think.
Yes.
It is. So
from Jerusalem, that's the one.
Yeah. So I've been to Jordan. I have relatives in Jordan. I have a lot of relatives in Jordan, actually, because my family's based in the West Bank, but between it was what a 48 to 60, 67. Even beyond that, Palestinians in the West Bank did have a right to go into Jordan. They were Jordanians, actually Jordanian citizens for a long time. So there are, like, for example, one of my uncles is he was born in the West Bank, is settled in Amman, and obviously that's a very different situation. So I've been through both Israel and Jordan to get into Palestine.
I also want to know if when you landed in Ben Gurion, did you get to travel a little bit around Israel?
Honestly, very little. I have not really traveled in Israel. I have done Ben Gurion Airport to Jerusalem, where I met my dad, and we traveled back into the West Bank. What we did do is my dad was married to someone from I don't know how much information I should give about various places, but my dad is married to someone who's is an Israeli citizen, Israeli Palestinian. So she has family in Israel proper, 1948. So I traveled in some cities in Israel as well, including Haifa and Nazareth. So I've been around a little bit. It was quite interesting sitting in the hotel in Nazareth and flicking through all the different Israeli channels. Of course, I don't speak Hebrew. I don't speak. I think one of them is actually in Russian. There was a Russian Israeli channel. So my Arabic is limited. When I watch Arabic TV, I recognize some phrases and I can follow it sometimes. But it's mostly because I've lived in UK and USA. My main language is English. So it was very interesting traveling in Israel a little bit. But I haven't. When you're traveling with your family and you're on other people's schedules, you don't have the opportunities to look around so much as I might have liked to do. Like, I would like to go to Tel Aviv. I've never been to Tel Aviv. I would like to go to, what is it? The Holocaust Memorial. Is it Yad Vashem, isn't it?
Yad Vashem, yes.
Yad Vashem, yes.
I'd like to go to that. I'd like to go to Galilee. I've been reading a lot of ancient archaeology about the land and the various places in the land where there have been Homo erectus remains, Homo heidelbergensis. One of the places I'd like to go to is a place called Tel Obadiah. It's near Galilee. So that was the first place where archaeologists found Homo erectus remains from 1.7 million years ago. So that's the first human habitation in the Holy Land. I would love to visit that. Of course, that was a Palestinian village before 1948, where the population eventually left and moved to Nazareth. But I have a great interest in, like, the ancient history and archaeology of the land.
John, I would like to go back to something you said before while describing what happened on October 7th. You mentioned on the raping. And, for me, it's really like it's really positive to hear someone like you speak out, not loud because you're calm, but but acknowledge, yes, there were rapings. I've spent the last 2 weeks in Blue Sky, a social network that I escaped from Twitter. I have a very large audience in Twitter, but I really quit on it because Elon Musk didn't feature a button or something to just banish Nazis jumping on top of your neck. And I said, okay, let's go to Blue Sky. Maybe there are less Nazis there. No, there's plenty of them denying the rapings, and hearing the acknowledgement of those atrocities coming from you, it's really like bring me hope, like, because I would like to find some guys with the guts to say there were no rapings. Saying that to your face, because saying that to a Jew or an Israeli, for them it's just like sport. They are happy to do that because they are sick. But when it comes to someone they are supposed to stand for and they should help them improve their material conditions, like you said, or the way they live, they are actually doing the opposite. So what do you think of those activists or those trolls patrolling and jumping on top of any Zionist and telling them Zionist? and using all kinds of lies, when I understand that you think they're not helping, what would you say to them?
I think it's incredibly important to be intellectually honest and to look to try and drop the side that you're from your thinking when you're trying to think about facts, because I think when you look at the evidence that emerged on October the 7th, there is no doubt whatsoever that there was sexual violence. That's just the physical reality. You know, when you have evidence of victims who have had their genitals mutilated, or that, you know, they've been burnt to death and they had their underwear removed before that, we can't deny the existence of atrocities, right? It's a very dangerous thing where we start denying the existence of atrocities. The problem is that people who perhaps are on the Palestinian side, right, they might come at me and be angry with me for acknowledging that there were these atrocities, because what their perspective is that what I'm doing is that I'm somehow justifying Israeli atrocities against Palestinians, or justifying, you know, the deaths of civilians in Gaza. But I think we have to take things issue by issue, and I don't think that acknowledging what happened on October the 7th in any way would justify atrocities against Palestinians or atrocities against Palestinian civilians. So it's very important to take things issue by issue and step by step. And where there is evidence of war crimes or atrocities on either side, I think it's incredibly important to acknowledge that and say, okay, this has happened. We don't condone it. We condemn it. And it is what it is. It's part of the fabric of our reality, rather than trying to deny it and trying to brush it under the carpet and to say, oh no, this behavior is forbidden in Islam, therefore no Hamas fighter would ever do that. I think it's very dangerous where we cannot be aware that, you know, people on both sides could commit atrocities because people are angry with each other, and that's this sort of anger and hatred and dehumanization, right, is what fuels the conflict. So I reject that. I recognize what happened on October the 7th. I condemn that, and I condemn any atrocities against Palestinians.
You've mentioned this concept, which is the fabric of reality. It brings me back with a term that was going around for a while, which is Pollywood. And the ultimate character that we saw online with memes, they call him Mr. Fuffle. It's the acronym for Fuck Around and Find Out, which is really tough from someone suffering what's happening on the Palestinian side. For us, it's like we're used to tragedies and we use humor to tackle down what happens on our reality. But what do you think, not only about the thing that you said about denying facts, but about creating fake news and videos and trying to, I mean, there are actual tragedies. What's the need of, like, having an industry of lies to deliver to the cause?
I mean, I first of all, I would say the overwhelming majority of deaths in Gaza are not in any way fabricated. There's been a vast amount of deaths. The proportion of Hamas fighters versus civilians probably is about 2 civilians for every 1 Hamas fighter, and that's according to the IDF's own statistics. So there's been a large number of Palestinian civilians who have died, and of course every innocent civilian death is a horrible tragedy, and I'm on that 100%. But I think that news organizations and people on social media have a real responsibility to be honest and to try and, you know, if you're spreading a video that's supposed to be of an atrocity, you need to make sure that it really is what you're saying it is. You need to ask people connected to it. If you took the footage yourself, you need to, you know, you can't cut it to take things out of context. I think it's very important to be honest with yourself as much as possible. And there have certainly been occasions where I've tweeted something
And then some context has been shown to me, and I've said, okay, I didn't see this context. I have to delete the tweet. Because I think from my perspective, we can't be spreading fake news. I think that's very fake news is very dangerous, and it leads people to more extremism, more hatred, more dehumanization, and that's what we don't want. We want a balanced view of reality where we accept that there's right and wrong on both sides, and where we accept that in the long run we need to be honest and we need to make peace with each other.
So I don't know how many on the Palestinian side are ready to accept Israel as a Jewish state with non-Jewish citizens, of course, equal rights, etc. And I want to reach out to find more. My question is, where are the leaders that can not only accept on the Palestinian side, but also do the nation building? As you know, one thing is to resist, one thing is to fight, one thing is to don't care about dying or sending your kids to die. And a different thing is to administer institutions. I think during the conflict, there have been several occasions, mostly after Oslo, but also before 1948, where the lack of, I don't want to say partner, because it's not just the agreement, it's the actual cleaning up the streets, providing education, providing health. Where do you think? Are the Palestinian leaders that can do the nation building? Because it's often said that Palestinian Arabs are the most educated of the Arab world. Maybe that, I think that's true, right?
I believe that's still true, yeah.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that being a good professional, being a good doctor, it's the same as having what Ben-Gurion called the Mamlachtiut, the institutional, the governance part of being responsible for a land, building institutions, establishing the courts of justice that would be fair, etc., etc. I know that, and sorry for this long introduction to the question. I think before 1948, before the defeat of the Arab armies, that Syrian Christian professor Konstantin Zurek called the Nakba, the defeat of the armies, and then it was reinterpreted as the tragedy for the Palestinian people. There were some, I don't know if they were the Nusaybi family, different clans that opposed Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Nazi leader of the Palestinian people during the Second World War, and uncle of Arafat. Those families, I think they were the first ones that fled the land even before the invasion. Did they reconstitute? Is there anybody that we as Jews can look to and say, okay, please govern this? Because the PA is so corrupt and they basically don't control anything outside of Ramallah. It's the Israeli government that goes after them, after terrorists, etc. What is your view from the institutional building on the Palestinian side?
I think that that's a very good question, and that really gets into the sort of mechanics of how would a two-state solution work. And I think it's incredibly important to recognize, first of all, that the PA does still accept the Oslo principles of recognizing Israel. So that is still the case. Yes, there are some people in the PA who are whose views are more leaning towards the Hamas position than maybe my position. But at the same time, the PA kind of exists in the gap between me and Hamas. So I would say that there certainly are people in the PA who do want to have peace. I would say that help for nation building for Palestinians can certainly come from across the Arab world, from outside Palestine. For example, from the UAE, I think we could be very fortunate to have help from the UAE. I think the UAE is, it's a very impressive country. I think Saudi Arabia could also be very helpful. You know, they are linking the creation of a two-state solution to the normalization of relations with Israel. So that would kind of scratch both of the backs of the Palestinian people and Israel. So that would be good for both. I think getting help in terms of nation building from nations that have had success, of course, Jordan is friendly to the Palestinians. It's done airdrops in Gaza to, you know, help Palestinians on the ground with aid. You know, they're very invested in the Palestinian people. Of course, the Palestinians in the West Bank were citizens of Jordan for a time. So, of course, they have a, and of course, the Jordanians are involved in the Waqf in Jerusalem. So they have a long history of involvement in the Palestinian.
For the people listening to the episode that are not familiar, the Waqf is the armed force that custodies the holy site for the Muslim religious people. It's like the Golden Dome and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
So I would say that getting help from across the Arab world would be incredibly important in terms of potential leaders who are more amenable to making peace with Israel. Of course, you have Mohammed Dahlan, who is in the UAE. He is a associate of the leaders of the UAE, so he has resources. He was involved in the creation of the Abraham Accords. He has a sort of diplomatic pedigree. He has a long history of involvement in Gaza and with the PA, and he's certainly a controversial figure in Palestinian politics. But if he was willing to take the job of, you know, making peace with Israel, I think he's a plausible contender because he does have a long track record of involvement in Gaza and managing Gaza and working with the PA. And I believe he's involved in distributing the aid in Gaza through the UAE right now. Another voice I would say who's plausible, is a little bit older, would be Salam Fayyad, who's maybe the closest to my views. You know, he condemns October the 7th. He is pro-peace in his rhetoric. He's lived in the US for many years, so he's quite westernized in his outlook. I would say Salam Fayyad is a plausible candidate. And he's one of the people who doesn't really have any corruption allegations against him. So I agree with Biden reforming and revamping the PA and putting into place Palestinians who want to have peace with Israel and who are not corrupt and who want the best for the Palestinian people, which, of course, in my view, is peace with Israel. That is the way forward, in my view.
Yeah. And if I may add, the institutional building that I'm referring to is precisely building the institutions so it does not depend on someone wanting or not to steal or being or not
corrupt. Exactly.
There's corruption everywhere, even in Israel. The thing is that Israel has a Supreme Court that, even with a Arab judge that put a Jewish prime minister to jail because of corruption. That's the institution part.
That's a weird apartheid. I can't believe it.
The thing is that sometimes the help from abroad, from NGOs or from the UN, comes in the way of like UNRWA that basically helped Hamas, not just by being a lot of them being members, I'm not referring to that part, but also taking away the civilian responsibilities in Gaza so that the Hamas government, if you want to call it like that, in 2007, etc., did not have to care about providing government. And that was in detriment to the ability or to the learning curve of managing the land, managing the health, education, because if they give you everything and you're not responsible for anything.
That's something that allows me to ask John, what would you think about not a two-state solution, but a three-state solution? Because it's evident that Gaza was taken over by Hamas, and the people that you mentioned that could lead a two-state solution, I'm not sure if they're going to be supported by the people in Gaza, which were mostly the ones that supported Hamas and maybe still support. Even though most of the people in the West Bank do not like the PA still stands in power. They don't like him. They think they are corrupt. But the institutional framework is still in place. As poor as you might think of it, but don't you think that after October 7th, you're going to have two different things? And maybe there has to be two different solutions for this two Palestinian states living with Israel, and then you have to have three states.
In principle, I agree with President Biden that the best solution is a revamped PA looking after all of it, but like realistically, one of the factors here is that the IDF is taking control of Gaza, and they're going to impose their solution on Gaza. And I think, from what I understand, they're talking about involving the clans and clan-based leadership on the ground, in who are people who are not necessarily political or politicized. So the management of Gaza will be done through more non-political bodies and organizations, as opposed to, you know, through the PA. Part of the reality of Hamas taking over is that the consequences of Hamas are now on the people of Gaza, and that includes the initiation of this war, and it also includes the after effects of this war. And ironically, I don't know if you know, but the vote share for Hamas in 2006, I think it was the last Palestinian election, was actually higher in the West Bank than in Gaza. And in repeated opinion polls of, you know, the West Bank and Gaza during this war, the rate of support for Hamas has been much higher in the West Bank. So, I mean, that is the PA's, Ramallah really is the PA's stronghold, but Hamas haven't managed to get into power in the West Bank. Of course, there are groups such as Islamic Jihad that are operating in the West Bank who are threatening to open up a new front in the war, because of course you have the Gaza front, you have the Lebanon front with Hezbollah, and you have groups in the West Bank who are suggesting that there should be a third front. So I hope that there is a two-state solution. That is my preference. A three-state solution, just if you, one factor that does kind of favor a three-state solution over a two-state solution is that Gaza and the West Bank are not contiguous. And from 48 to 67, of course, Gaza was administered by Egypt and the West Bank was administered by Jordan, because, of course, those are the countries who are adjacent to those places. So you would tend to think that could be a factor. The fact that they're not contiguous, yes, you've had various suggestions like a road and rail corridor. That would be what I favor in a two-state solution. You'd have a road and rail corridor that link the two so you can drive.
Or maybe an actual tunnel that would not be used to abduct citizens from Israel. I mean, if you can spend millions on that terror network underground, I mean, imagine using that money to have a tunnel network that connects.
I would say a road and rail tunnel linking Gaza and the West Bank would have been a much better use of all of that tunneling expertise that, of course, is in Gaza. There are lots of people in Gaza who know an awful lot about how to build tunnels.
Not like I use it for something good.
if there is going to be a road and rail tunnel between Gaza and the West Bank, then, you know, there is the expertise to make that happen, because I think the vision should be you should be able to drive from Rafah to Jenin without going through one Israeli checkpoint, so you have a contiguous Palestinian state. If we end up in a three-state solution, then we have to hope it's a peaceful one, right? That should be the goal. But for now, I'm still favoring a two-state solution.
I would just add something, because you mentioned the checkpoint a couple of times, and I haven't experienced a checkpoint. I think the only moment that I went through a harsh one was when I had to cross to Jordan to go for Petra, which is really not hard. I mean, they treat me really nice. And I think in Russia, in Moscow, it's like you really feel like just going through somewhere that are really like, where are you coming from? What are you expecting to do here? What I want to say is that I cannot say that I understand what it feels like to go through a checkpoint, but I can understand that it really can piss someone off if it has to be done on a regular basis. But how can you connect the fact that if we reach some sort of agreement and the weapons and the stop the violent solution and maybe start for a quick three-state solution or a two-stage, two-state solution, because Gaza is going to take really more time and the West Bank is really already functioning. Good or bad, but it's functioning. It's closer to a state than what is happening in Gaza. How can you tell to a Palestinian, to an average Palestinian guy that maybe supports Hamas, that, look, this is the way that the checkpoints are going to disappear from your life? What's your conversation with a Palestinian with regards to this?
I mean, Palestinians don't want to live under Israeli occupation. That is, you know, when I speak to Palestinians, the number one thing Palestinians cite is a grievance, either to justify Hamas, or if not justifying Hamas, to explain Hamas is there is a military occupation and we don't like it. We don't like having to live our lives under the watch of soldiers from another country. And I think that that is how Palestinians very strongly feel. And I think they are very, very unhappy with it. And I think that if in terms of selling the viability of a two-state solution to Palestinians, I think that this would end the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and there would be independence, and there wouldn't be any more Israeli soldiers on the street. I think that's a very, very, very strong incentive for people to want to go for that. And of course, I think having a Palestinian state that is recognized by the world and recognized by the US and the UK and Israel, and you can have your Palestinian passport and you can go into any country, I think that would be great. I think a lot of Palestinians would be excited for that. I think if you show people, you know, the success that has been achieved by other Arab countries in building, you know, modern cities and, you know, places like the UAE and the fantastic, you know, architecture and infrastructure that they have there, I think a lot of Palestinians will be inspired by that as well. So I think for me, what I want to paint is a really aspirational picture of really successful, economically successful Palestinian state that is not dependent on foreign aid. It's not dependent on UNRWA. It's not dependent on Israel. It's not dependent upon having to get a job in Israel and go and work in Israel. No, there will be jobs in Palestine. There will be a modern infrastructure in Palestine the way there is in the UAE, you know. And I think that's the vision that I want to sell, is a really positive, upbeat vision that people can get behind.
I would really love you to have success convincing people, because when the Abraham Accords started to spread around, and you know, my grandma, she's buried in Israel, and she dreamt about going to Dubai to see the tennis, I don't know which tournament, she really loved tennis. And I said, okay, the Abraham Accords maybe came a little late in her life, but you know, it's the kind of stuff that people enjoy, just countries being open for each other and trading and having tourism. And but those countries, those Arab countries that you're mentioning, like the Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia, which were really close to recognize Israel before October 7th, are somehow rivaling Iran, which is supporting the other alternative, the one that actually led to October 7th. So what would you put on top of that sales pitch towards this Palestinian that you're talking to, saying, we just go for this? But how would you convince to disregard what the Ayatollah's regime is selling them?
I think what the Ayatollah's regime is selling them is endless struggle, really, isn't it? I mean, this is my pitch, is that Hamas's ideology has been tried. Hamas's ideology led to this war. Hamas's ideology is endless, continuous struggle until Israel's destroyed. And they will say, well, what about Algeria, right? We had this, you know, 130-odd-year war, liberation struggle against the French Algerians, and eventually they left. And to that, my first point is that it's important to remember that Israel is not a colony. It's not a colony of another country. It's an independent state. And the people who live in Israel do not actually have anywhere to go. Right.
I would so like to applaud you, man, because you know it's really strong to hear you saying this.
Well, this is factual. This is factual. Yeah. Right or wrong, this is factual. Israel is not a colony. Israel is an independent country, and it's also an independent country with nuclear weapons. And it's completely absurd. It's completely absurd to say that there's going to be a resistance. You know, a resistance movement the Palestinian resistance movement is going to destroy Israel. I think that's absurd. I think that that's the pathway to more death and suffering. And I think that's just factual. That's just factual.
What I used to say after October 7 is terror attacks can make lives miserable.
Yeah.
On both sides, but also on Israel. But it's not an army. It's not. The Palestinian resistance does not have the power to invade Israel and destroy it with boots on the ground. So blowing up cafes, pizzerias, It will make life harder, but it will not make Israel go away or Israelis. And talking about hard life, the checkpoints, there was a plan in 2020 to modernize them, to make them automatic, and it was rejected by the Palestinians because it was embellishing the cage. It was making the occupation more permanent. So it's like a cycle, a vicious circle of, okay, let's try to get more trust and more security at the same time and make life better, but it cannot function because it goes back to, no, we just want you out. And
that's something worth remarking. When you spend time with young Israelis, people like the ones they were slaughtered in the Nova Party, these guys, they only want to dance, get high, find someone to love. I don't know. They don't want to just go and control what the Palestinians are doing. Their life goals are something else. I mean, they're into something different. They actually finish the army, the 3-year training, and they just travel around the world. There's generation after generation that they didn't want to know nothing with war, and now they are proud warriors. So you have a generation that was put to test because they were not up to what their fathers and grandfathers did because they didn't have the opportunity. Now they gave it. So the moment you just help a Palestinian understand, look, as long as you have an armed resistance, there's going to be some sort of reaction from the other side trying to at least put some countermeasures and control until the weapons are lower to zero or something like that. How do you think about the possibility of getting the average Palestinian to understand this, that it's not what the average Israeli really loves to be into this?
I think that this is sort of a long-term thing that is going to come through. It's going to come through experience because, as I say, the Palestinian side has tried Hamas's methods, right? And they've led us to what we are seeing in Gaza today, which is basically a complete defeat of Hamas. And on top of that, you know, tens of thousands of Palestinian casualties, which obviously I'm incredibly sad that that's happened because, you know, many of those people were friends or relatives of people who I know and people who I speak to. So obviously that's something I don't want to see happening again. So I think in terms of, I guess your question is to do with how Palestinians can understand the Israeli mentality a bit better. And I think that probably, I'm an advocate for a two-state solution, but I'm also an advocate for people meeting each other and talking to each other and trying to understand each other. And that can be through music, it can be through sports, it can just be through Twitter. I mean, I will say one of the advantages of me being a Palestinian with a, you know, fairly substantial Israeli Zionist following is that sometimes you do get conversations in my comment section between people who maybe are there and more maybe they're an ideological Hamas supporter and maybe someone in Israel, maybe they're a sort of more of a Palestinian Authority hardliner and someone in Israel. So, these conversations will probably have to take place in English because English kind of serves as a lingua franca between the two sides, or certainly in relation to in the comment sections that on my threads, that's in English. But I suppose to some extent, if Jews in Israel want to learn Arabic, if Palestinians want to learn Hebrew, then, that's very worthwhile because I think people do need to get to know each other on a human level in order to humanize the other. Because I think it's very important. It's very important we recognize that we're humans on both sides, right? Dehumanization of either side is not the answer. I know that there are people who've done horrible things. There have been horrible deaths and murders. And, you know, thousands of people have lost their lives. But I think we have to, if we really want peace, if we really want to live together, we have to start understanding people on a human level. So, of course, I agree, and I would encourage Palestinians and Israelis to talk to each other and try and befriend each other. Maybe that sounds crazy.
It doesn't sound crazy. It reminds me of the movie Oslo, where they recreated the moment they put them, without telling them, the people involved in each party that are going to meet, and they serve something to eat, and they put them just to do human stuff together and see what happens. Then we talk politics. I agree with you, John. Having this kind of conversation, I mean, it's going to take some time. It's going to be hard because we are mourning on both sides.
Both sides,
We have an idea of who's to blame. And I thank you for standing against Hamas, which is basically the one to blame. I mean, I only wish for your voice to be as loud as possible to help people like you start talking louder and become the common sense. And,
thank you.
Then stuff is going to happen. I'm optimistic right now.
So do you believe it is important or critical for Hamas to be defeated to be able to establish some kind of a road to peace?
I think that the nature of Hamas is that they will be defeated simply because they don't want to give up power in Gaza very easily. There were plausible pathways to a ceasefire and a permanent ceasefire if Hamas was to release the Israeli hostages and if their leaders, at least, were to vacate Gaza and, you know, go to Algeria or Tunisia or wherever. You know, that this was discussed in some of the Egyptian and Qatari ceasefire proposals. And Hamas does not want to do that because I think to some extent, they're high on their own supply. They believe in what they're selling. I think they're true believers, at least some of them are, in their, you know, jihadist ideology. And I think that they will be much happier to die fighting the IDF on their own land than they would be to go to Algeria and be in exile. Maybe other people in the Hamas movement, maybe someone like Ismail Haniyeh, is not so much of a true believer. He's basically a grifter, right? He's in it for the money. And there's a mixture of those. But I think certainly, you know, Sinwar and Deif, who are leading the war in Gaza, are true believers. So they want to fight on, and nothing would satisfy them more than jihad for the sake of Allah to be martyred in Palestine. So it is what it is.
That's a given. The problem is not that they want to die for the cause. The problem is that they don't care how many civilians and other people and combatants die and Gaza is destroyed. If they want to die killing Israelis, well, that's their decision, but they are deciding to keep hostage not just the Israelis that are still in Gaza, but everybody else. And also, it's not just them that they are the believers. The pro-Palestinian rallies in the rest of the world, or at least in the Western capitals, they, at least those that support Hamas, and I think I have not seen a Palestinian march that does not support Hamas.
It's complex. It's complex because a lot of people in those marches don't really know what from the river to the sea even means. They don't know which river and which sea. Like, I think there is some level of sympathy for Hamas, but I would be careful about labeling most of the people in those rallies to be Hamas supporters.
Yeah, maybe I explained myself poorly. What I'm trying to say is that the Sinwar and Deif and all the leadership in Gaza is not only high on their own supply, it's high on the supply that they get from the Western rallies. They think that they're doing something great.
That's true.
It's like it's the rear guard in there because it was the whole plan. They thought, okay, we go in, we kill as many as we can, we control territory, then Hezbollah will enter West Bank. Maybe they thought of that. But in any case, they thought, as we are trenched within the civilian population, we will have our allies in the West to call a ceasefire.
Mm-hmm.
That was the plan of Hamas. And going back to the first question I asked, so the defeat of Hamas, is it necessary? So what do you say to those people that say, and they tell me, you can't defeat Hamas because Hamas is an idea?
That's the thing. That's probably true to some extent, that Hamas is an idea, and the only you can defeat an idea, actually. So that's wrong. You can defeat an idea. What you defeat an idea with is a better idea. But I that's and my vision is promoting better ideas that will lead to more happiness and more prosperity for Palestinian people and less misery and suffering. So that's my perspective. I would say that the rallies in the Western countries absolutely are. They're giving sukkah, they're giving a lot of confidence to Hamas, because they think that Hamas certainly think that the people chanting from the river to the sea, they're accepting our beliefs, right? That's what they're going off. The other thing that maybe concerns me a bit is that the one get out of jail free card might well be World War III, right? Where Palestine and Israel would just be one front in a greater confrontation between the new axis, which would be Russia, China, Iran, and the United States and their allies, including Israel, on the other side. So I think the quote-unquote axis of resistance is hoping, really, if they really want to achieve their military goals, their best hope for that might well be, you know, global war, which is a scary thing to think about and something that I very, very much hope doesn't happen. But it's a small but growing possibility, I think.
Yes, the how to fight an idea, I think personally that Hamas needs to be defeated militarily and then also as an idea. But in the West Bank, I see videos about the schools in UNRWA that they would make a German Nazi blush. They would, the type of things that they teach the kids. The kids themselves tell it. I want to grow up and die as a martyr. I want to kill Jews. I want to run over them. And this is 8 years old, 7 year olds, 10 year olds. I want to stab a Jew. I'm ready to die for my country. So I can assure you, I have family in Israel. They don't learn the same thing. They learn from early ages that they long for peace. Of course, that peace is not free and they eventually need to fight to defend it, but it's not a culture of death as we see on the other side. And this is not Hamas run. This is in the West Bank. Well, Hamas may have supporters, but it's not run by them. And this goes under the UNRWA, which is managed by Palestinians, but supposedly it's run by the UN at supervised. We know it's not, but and the PA. So how do we get out of that from a education perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best way to end UNRWA is the creation of a Palestinian state, and I think the best way to reform education in a Palestinian state would be to make sure that there's, you know, both appropriate educational resources and appropriate funding that will allow a better system to be put in place. And so I certainly would that's something. If I was part of the PA and I was looking to build a country, I think indoctrinating your children into the ideology of, you know, endless warfare to recapture lost land that is now part of Israel, I think that's quite a dangerous situation for the Palestinian state to be putting itself into, because it would risk a future confrontation with Israel. Because if you have people growing up to believe, you know, Haifa and Tel Aviv, this is all Palestinian land and we're going to get it back, then that is sowing the seeds for future conflict. You know, I live in the UK, and a large part of France was once part of an English kingdom. If in the UK school children were being taught that this French land is actually really English land and we should go and invade it in a holy war, I think that would be quite a dangerous thing too. So I would be very, very careful about wanting to teach irredentism to children. I think that's the attitude that the Palestinian Authority needs to take if people want to live in peace in the future.
Yeah, and it's, you don't have to go that far back. At the time that the Israel declared its independence, also, there was a big numbers of refugees and displaced and interchange of populations between Germany, Poland, India, Bangladesh. If you open up that door, you're opening up the doors of hell.
That's what Putin did.
That's what Putin did, exactly.
Yeah. I think education is an issue on many levels all across the planet. I mean, we have the universities having a serious problem just explaining a huge amount of young people that the problem with the war was that it was a colonization game from an imperium. And then we're going to have to work really hard to reverse that, because it's not that history didn't happen, but it's not determinant. Because the moment you enter into that kind of perspective, you only go downwards. And what you said, John, about switching the education chip and installing something new, I think it's going to be hard and it's going to take time, because it's like, okay, what happened? I mean, last year they told us that they stole our land, and this year the curriculum says that they didn't steal it. So it's going to be like a little bit schizophrenic. I'm pretty sure it's not going to be the same teacher, because one of the ideas floating around is that maybe they have to import teachers maybe from the Emirates. They speak Arab, they are nice people, they are leading the region, so they're going to have like beautiful teachers from a new country with new fresh ideas, and working slowly to forget what we learned from the past and building a new story. Not to love Israelis, not necessarily. I mean, maybe it's going to happen like in Egypt, that they don't love each other. But you know what? The Sinai was open, and Israelis just crossed the border, and they spent shekels diving or going to parties, and everything just started to flow, okay? They didn't have to be friends. They trade. They share information. Maybe there will come a day where they will just sell each other technology for making the land green again. So that storytelling through the education system, I think it is going to require people from abroad, aside from switching the curriculum. Do you think it might work? Because it's like, what are these Emiratis doing here, teaching our children this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a valid concern. I think a lot of national identity and a lot of politics is inherited not from the schooling system, but from your family. And you know, if the school is teaching, you know, Israel came into existence in 1948, and there was a Nakba, and Palestinians were not able to go back. But now we accept that there's a two-state solution, and this part is Palestine, and this other part here is Israel, and we accept that, and that's going to be the ongoing situation. Where if the school's teaching that, then children will still believe their parents if their parents are saying from the river to the sea in at home. So you know, a culture of peace and a culture of coexistence is not going to happen overnight. And we know it's not going to happen overnight. This isn't an easy game, right? This is a very long, long-term and complex situation to deal with. And getting Palestinians on board with the idea of a two-state solution and peace and coexistence is a difficult task for any wannabe Palestinian person who wants to have long-term peace of Israel. Just as I suppose you may have difficulties if you go and you try to debate a supporter of Ben-Gvir about the Palestinian cause, and I talk to, you know, Ben-Gvirists and Kahanists actually every day, and their perspective in a lot of cases is all of the land belongs to us from the Nile to the Euphrates. So in many different societies, there are people with ideas like this, and I think managing this is a challenge for any society, and certainly Palestinians are going to have their work cut out in managing this.
Ben-Gvir was originally a Kurdish Jew.
He was, yeah.
That he was secular, but the first Intifada turned him into what he is now. So the cycle of violence works.
Cycle of violence. Absolutely. It radicalizes people. And unfortunately, there are probably people in Gaza who are very secular and very against Hamas who have been radicalized by this ongoing conflict. So, of course, we have to address the cycle of violence. And the most important factor in getting an end to that is to stop the violence as soon as possible.
John, I think we could spend like a whole additional hour discussing about so many things. But I would like first to thank you again, Shukran Gatilan, for your time, for sharing your thoughts, for sharing them loud and quietly at the same time. I really hope that when this episode comes out, it can spread like wildfire and be an example of, first of all, the possibility of a conversation, just a conversation, and a respectful one, and even having the opportunity to laugh at some stuff. And then I only wish you the best in this journey of thinking different. I know you have it tough. I mean, for us, we're used to discuss it between Israelis, Jews, having demonstrations on the streets and shouting at each other and jumping at each other's neck on the Passover dinner and on the Rosh Hashanah, because we're used to this. We're used to think different and fight each other, but we are one strong nation, stronger than ever. Some of us, we still think that, I don't know if a two or a three state solution, but something has to be done because nobody's going anywhere.
Yeah.
Violence at some point has to finish. Hamas has to be terminated. And let's hope one day we can walk around the streets of Ramallah or anywhere in the and then jump on a low-cost airplane to Tel Aviv and rave around. They have beautiful nightclubs with the best music you can hear. Yeah, that's a nice way of finishing this. I will leave Apu the opportunity to use a word that I learned, which is really beautiful in Arab.
The word is tasharrafna, which means it's been an honor to meet you.
Shukran. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And just to summarize my feelings, I feel like we have not solved anything, but we have started with having conversations, spreading your voice and understanding your points of view is the necessary part of a brighter future. And I really hope that we see it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Salam alaikum.